Welcome back to Midpoint, friends, on this February 11th, 2026. We are a few days early, but this is our Valentine's Day special show. We call it When Romance Goes Wrong. No hearts and flowers and lovey-dovey stuff for us here at Midpoint. We're looking at what happens when the hearts and flowers and sweet nothings all fade away. And instead of love and affection, all that's left is abuse and trauma. This is our show about bad romance. We will be talking with our guests, Kelly Sin, CEO of Sunrise of Pasco County, a domestic and sexual violence center, and with William Warmke, Supervisor of the Hillsborough County State Attorney's Office Domestic Violence Division, about when romance goes bad. They will be with us in just a few minutes after our news nuggets of the week. Let's start off on a positive note. Well, Florida must have, like hell, actually frozen over, because I have a bit of good legislative news to tell you about. The Florida Senate is moving forward with a bill that we can wholeheartedly support. Senate Bill 460 would require the governor of Florida to call a special election within 2 weeks of a vacancy in the legislature. It also allows a petition to be filed with the courts if the governor fails to call an election within the deadline, and it will allow the courts to set a special election date. Governor DeSantis has been very tardy in setting special election dates, leaving citizens without any representation in the legislature for much longer than is necessary. When State Senator Jay Collins was tapped to be lieutenant governor and he resigned his seat in the Senate, it took the governor 73 days to just set an election date to fill his seat, and DeSantis only did it after he was taken to court over the delay. Let's face it, DeSantis was playing politics by leaving the seat open for so long. It's hard to have representative democracy without representation. And why risk getting representation you don't like if you have the power to prevent it? In a probable swing Senate district like the one Republican Jay Collins left, it was probably in the Republicans' political interest to leave it vacant for as long as possible. Why not? The citizens of District 14 were ignored, but the Republicans had nothing to lose while the seat sat empty, as they already held a supermajority in the legislature. The last thing they needed was a Democrat possibly winning that seat and cutting into their supermajority. It still will not lose the Republicans their supermajority if a Democrat wins now, but it would be a start in winnowing it down. And now, finally, that election for State Senate District 14 is on the horizon, now scheduled for Tuesday, March 24th. So if you live in Senate District 14, and you can easily check this for yourself on votehillsborough.gov, please make plans to vote. Don't waste your chance to make your priorities heard after so long without a voice. And while you are on the website, votehillsborough.gov, make sure you are properly registered and that the elections office has your preference for a mail ballot if that's like how you like to vote. Remember, your request for a mail ballot has expired, and it must be renewed by February 23rd to vote by mail in this election. All right, the candidates in this race are Democrat Brian Nathan, a Navy veteran and a union electrician and first-time candidate from Hillsborough County, and Josie Tomcow, a multimillionaire state house representative from Polk County, who is actually being sued in a lawsuit that alleges that she is not eligible to run for this seat because she's not a Hillsborough County resident as required by law. That case is still pending. Now, in some local news, the Tampa Bay Times reports that the city of St. Petersburg has taken another small step toward determining whether it will drop Duke Energy and operate a municipal-run electric utility. After a request by Mayor Ken Welch's administration, the administration has started accepting bids from consulting companies to complete a study evaluating the pros and cons of the move. According to the project description, the study would assess whether a city-run utility would help lower the cost of residents' electric bills, and if city control would make it easier for St. Petersburg to achieve its clean energy goals, among other potential benefits. And of course, you know, we followed this issue in the city of Clearwater earlier this year on Midpoint. Richie Floyd, who's a city council person from St. Petersburg, was one of the people on the show who was promoting this for the city of St. Petersburg, and now it looks like they are moving forward with exploring this possibility. All right, let's see what the Republican supermajority is up to in the legislature right now. First, Republicans on a Florida House committee advanced a measure yesterday to honor murdered conservative activist Charlie Kirk over the objections that such a tribute would come as an insult to black people, women, and others. The House State Affairs Committee voted 18-7 to designate October 14th as a Charlie Kirk Day of Remembrance amid a fierce debate over Kirk's legacy, First Amendment rights, and the treatment of black members of the Florida legislature. If you have some strong feelings about this issue, you should let your representatives know. And a proposal to place portraits of Presidents George Washington and Abraham Lincoln in every public school in Florida is ready for a vote in the full Senate. The Rules Committee on Tuesday approved a measure, Senate Bill 420, that requires each school district to adopt rules regarding the display of the portraits. You know, I'm not opposed to the display of Washington and Lincoln per se, but I question whether this is another unfunded mandate put upon our public schools. Who's paying for this? And why can't those funds be better used for teacher pay and instructional matters? It seems like a waste of the very limited funds our legislature allows our public schools and gives them to work with lately on educational matters. And finally, two South Florida voters want the state Supreme Court to determine if Governor Ron DeSantis has the authority to call for a mid-decade congressional redistricting and to delay candidate qualifying. The voters are suing to stop the mid-decade redistricting effort by DeSantis. Their petition asks the court to determine if the governor's January 7th proclamation for a special legislative session the week of April 20th to redraw congressional districts encroached on the power of the legislature as it proclaimed 2026 is a, quote, year in which the legislature will apportion the state, close quote. This is a legal argument over who has the power to call a special election, to call for redistricting. The Florida legislature, which is wary of redistricting and risking their very safe seats into what may turn out to be more competitive races, like what recently happened in Texas, where the Republicans redistricted and then lost a solidly Republican seat to a Democrat. Or does the governor have the power to impose redistricting on the legislature mid-decade? Florida is different from California, where that governor's push for mid-decade redistricting was put on the ballot and was approved by California voters in November. We don't have that on our ballot in Florida. But last week, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the California redistricting plan, and this is presumed to result in a net gain of Democratic seats in California in the midterm elections. So we'll be following this court case in Florida with interest. All right, I want to welcome my guests for today. Kelly Sin is the CEO of Sunrise of Pasco. Kelly began her career at Sunrise Domestic and Sexual Violence Center in 2002, I'm sorry. And she was selected as CEO in 2013. She graduated from USF with her master's degree, and she holds a Florida license as a clinical social worker. So welcome, Kelly, and happy future Valentine's Day.
Oh, thank you for having me.
William Warmke was promoted to supervising attorney in the Domestic Violence Division of the Hillsborough County State Attorney's Office back in November after serving as a line prosecutor in the division. His boss, State Attorney Susie Lopez, has said that he has been a driving force in prosecuting complex domestic violence cases, supporting survivors, and guiding their team with expertise and compassion. So thanks for being with us today, William.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Let me start with you, Kelly. What I find so interesting about your background is that you come from a direct services background. You are actually a trained social worker, and so you worked with abused clients as a social worker, and you brought that experience to your role as CEO of the domestic abuse shelter. So many CEOs of nonprofits come from some business background with management and fundraising expertise, but you come from a client services background. Do you think that makes a difference in how you manage Sunrise and a program like the Sunrise Shelter offers?
So that's an interesting question, because I do think that my background in having done the direct service work has positioned me, sometimes to better understand, having worked directly with survivors for so very long before taking on a leadership role, it helps me to better understand some of the needs that they are experiencing, in addition to some of the programmatic growth, strengthening within the agency. I feel like I can better support staff as they continue to do the work and to support survivors.
Because you used to be staff, right?
I was. And so when they come with, concerns or ideas to grow programs or ways to support survivors, I feel like I can really understand, because I had walked that walk at one point in time. So, truthfully, I never had any intention of leading an agency. It just kind of fell on my lap naturally. My heart has always been with, providing that direct service, and certainly my degree and moving into being a licensed clinician, I've always wanted that direct service work. But I can see the impact that I'm able to have in a leadership role in supporting survivors and supporting staff, and it just kind of fit naturally. And certainly social work, you think of the therapy and you think of counseling and support, but luckily, the degree also is kind of broad, so you do go over the management and leadership. You do talk about grants, because, typically social workers get into nonprofits and you need to know how to write grants.
Sure.
To support the agency.
Right.
So.
Well, okay, let's talk about what kind of services does Sunrise actually provide now. Now, first of all, you're located in Dade City, right? In Pasco or where?
So we do cover all of Pasco County.
Okay.
And so Sunrise is interesting, right? We're positioned a little bit different because we carry dual certifications. So we are a state certified domestic violence center, but we're also a state certified rape crisis center. So we provide both of those services. Certainly we have the emergency shelter for those that are in imminent risk or in danger of being harmed or potentially killed by somebody. So we have that. And if you think about all of the complex services that then somebody who is leaving their home would then have to really, we try to bring wraparound services to folks, whether it's case management, counseling. 99% of survivors are faced with financial abuse. So we have programming specific to economic empowerment and helping them rebuild their own lives and to become self-sufficient away from an abuser. And then, beyond that, we have outreach counseling, which is the support, whether it's somebody who just isn't quite ready for shelter, maybe they've left the shelter, but they want some continued support beyond that, is really what our outreach program focuses on. And then we do have an injunction for protection project. So injunctions are really kind of similar to restraining orders, but are specific to violence. And so we have a legal program to include attorneys that are able to represent survivors as they're seeking injunctions or trying to obtain injunctions, because sometimes with survivors, they have such a huge story to tell, and trying to focus that down and to really convey the danger that they're fearing from the abuse, and trying to eloquently share that with a judge so that they can get something.
And find the proof, right, William? That's one of the things that the courthouse anyway, I'm not sure if it's your division or whether there's a particular division in the Hillsborough County Courthouse that deals with domestic abuse injunctions, but finding the proof of that, where people come with such highly intense emotional complaints, but finding the proof that there is a danger of violence is often difficult. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. And we see a lot of that when people apply for petitions for injunctions, that they try to go to the courthouse, they'll fill out their petitions, and it's all in writing. And then they'll have these hearings set where they are to appear, and their abuser is also supposed to appear in that same room. And that provides in and of itself its own challenges. This is someone who they're trying to get away from, someone who they're trying to be protected from, and yet now they're in a courtroom with that same person that they've been trying to escape. And now they have to make their case to a judge of why an injunction should be granted. And the thresholds are high thresholds. The judge has to find that there is a risk of violence or that an act of violence has occurred in a lot of these types of injunctions. And so for them to come unprepared or not understand the full process really puts them at a disadvantage, which is why it's important that we collaborate with nonprofits who are familiar with the injunction process. And that way we can refer survivors to go through those processes. And that way they're as best prepared as it can be for these injunction hearings.
So someone in Hillsborough County who feels threatened with violence by their abuser, the process for them, where would they go as opposed to in Pasco? Apparently they could seek out Sunrise and they could be guided through this injunction process. Where would they go in Hillsborough County?
And so for Hillsborough County, the designated domestic violence shelter and center is the Spring of Tampa Bay.
The Spring of Tampa Bay, right.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so they also have shelter services. They also have injunction services, social work services for survivors, and also collaborate very much so with the Sunrise. CASA in Pinellas County is a
CASA
very similar.
Is the program in Pinellas.
That's right.
Similar program.
Yep. And Spark, I believe, is down in the Sarasota and Bradenton area, and they could do a very similar service for there. So it's about coordinating with all of those resources.
So, okay, and what's the threshold, that someone would have to be able to establish in order to obtain an injunction against the person they've accused of abusing them? It's more than just an emotional abuse or financial abuse, right?
Yeah, it's often the risk of actual physical harm. And they have to demonstrate that an act of harm did occur or an act of harm is about to occur in order for a judge to find this, to make this finding in order to issue that injunction.
How do they prove that prospectively? An act of crime is about to occur, imminent. How would they prove that prospectively? I mean, I used to be a criminal defense attorney, so it's, how are you going to do that?
It's complicated because it depends on how the case really began. There are so many different ways for a survivor to become involved in the process. Their first contact with the system might be with a domestic violence agency like Sunrise, and to be meeting with an advocate to understand the process, to talk to an injunction survivor. Their first contact might also be a law enforcement officer responding to a scene to a first act of domestic violence. And so they might not be familiar with resources that are available in their community or in their area, and they might go into these hearings kind of blind to the resources available to them. And so really that's kind of my hope here, is kind of break the silence on domestic violence. And that way survivors know what resources they can receive before they go there. If they contact law enforcement, then they're referred to our office, and our office has its own dedicated victim assistance program. So we also have victim advocates who are assigned to both domestic violence cases specifically and to sex crime cases specifically, but any crime with a victim, period. So our victim advocates are trained to be aware of these resources so that we can make those referrals, that we can educate these victims so that their first contact is with us. We want to make sure that they're educated on it.
So, Kelly, let me ask you, when someone comes to a program like Sunrise in Pasco with the issues that William just talked about, do they often just want to get away from their abuser and not want to go through the process of prosecuting them for the reasons, some of which William talked about? I don't want to see him anymore. Let me back up and say, first of all, your program is mostly geared toward assisting women, right? But it's not exclusive. Is it exclusively for women? I mean, there are people in all kinds of relationships that may feel that they need the kind of services you provide, right?
Yes, certainly. So statistically, right, majority of victims of domestic violence are female. But we don't exclude any other, it doesn't matter. If you are a victim, is a victim for us, really. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what our focus is to support a victim or a survivor of abuse so that we can try to help them establish safety. And I think, certainly you had mentioned about, the kind of the fear and the overwhelming feeling of going through the, you know, the judicial system is, I mean, packets of an injunction packet is, you know, almost an inch thick, and it's very intimidating. And so certainly people may come into services and just say, I just need a respite. I need to get away. And I think that's part of understanding and really kind of meeting that survivor where they are. And that's that our hope certainly is that they will proceed on. There will be a prosecution. We'll, you know, take care of the bad person and make sure that they are not able to hurt anybody else. But that's not always the reality. And, you know, it's even important to share that statistically it takes somebody leaving 7 to 10 times before they stay away.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so knowing that we have planted a seed. So maybe they come and they stay for a few days and they go back, but they know we're here. So now they're going to reach out again, and maybe they're going to stay a little bit longer until finally something has happened that they want to stay away from that. Again, power and control is really interesting, but certainly going back to the judicial system and the process, it can be very daunting. Super helpful to have, you know, folks in the system that actually focus on working with survivors so that they are trauma informed and they're educated. They know what it feels like to, you know, to work with somebody that has been exposed to trauma to such severe extent, and understanding, you know, those stories don't always sometimes follow like an A to Z, but they kind of hop around because that's how trauma resonates in a brain.
And is someone eligible for your services only if they've experienced or are imminently about to experience violence?
So we do provide services to secondary survivors through, you know, our outreach counseling. So that could be a mom whose child was abused or, you know, sexually abused. It could be, you know, a spouse of somebody who had experienced abuse in their childhood. So it doesn't have to necessarily be somebody who is at the brink of being hurt, right? Because emotional abuse, you know, sometimes bumps and bruises, they go away. But what you hear, what's told to you, that emotional abuse is really hard.
Yeah. Okay. William, what do you do if someone declines to prosecute, or in the middle of their case, they just go, I can't go through with this? I mean, I know that that happens.
Yeah. These cases are complicated. These are people who they share children with, finances with, housing with,
right,
have to split bills with. And so we understand the complexity of that situation. And a lot of people come to our office and request to not move forward. And they kind of express those concerns to us. But it's ultimately up to the state of Florida whether ultimately to make that decision. And so sometimes it's a conversation piece with them. And I like to be transparent and just kind of explain that, like, I see your point of view. I see your concerns. I know what you don't want to see happen. But I also have my concerns. And so I might point out that fact that there were visible injuries, or I might talk about prior incidents that have been reported. And I'm going to explain to them that, like, I'm the bad guy here, not you. And so if there's family pressure on you that you tried to drop the charges, you tell them that you talked to the state attorney. But it was the state attorney who ultimately made that call and decided to move forward with that prosecution.
So you will, in some cases, move forward even without the cooperation of the victim?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. And what kind of things go into that decision? What kind of facts or, you know, considerations go into that decision?
Yeah, it's multifaceted. Really, we evaluate each case on a case-by-case basis. But things I'm looking for are lethality factors. If there has been allegations of strangulation, if there have been threats to harm or kill someone in the past or harm their children or pets, we want to look at that information. And we've actually been working with our new the sheriff's office has a new dedicated domestic violence unit with 10 dedicated detectives, a sergeant, and a corporal. And so we just updated our lethality assessment. And now we're using that information when we're going through that intake process. And that intake process is where we're ultimately deciding, are we going to proceed or are we not going to proceed? The reality is we don't proceed on every single case. You know, there are some times where there might not be enough evidence to proceed. In a civil injunction hearing, the burden is more likely than not. And that's what they have to convince the judge of.
More likely than not, as
yep.
opposed to beyond yep. a reasonable doubt.
Exactly.
Right.
And so that's the burden we're up against in the criminal justice
sure.
system, which is the highest burden of being able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And so we take an approach towards evidence-based prosecutions and try to talk to the witnesses or the victims about their experiences, about the evidence we have collected, and from body-worn cameras taken from law enforcement.
Okay. You're listening to WMNF 88.5 FM, and this is Midpoint with Shelley, and we are talking about bad romance, toxic romance, all the bad things that might happen in a relationship at the very, very far end of a bad romance, abuse and violence. And we are here with my guests, Kelly Sin from Pasco County, Sunrise of Pasco, Domestic and Sexual Violence Program, and William Warmke, who is the supervisor of the Domestic Violence Division at the Hillsborough County State Attorney's Office. And if you have any questions for my guests or comments, I'd like you to give us a call at 813-239-9663, or you can send me an email to dj@wmnf.org or a text message at 813-433-0885. Okay, let me talk about, you know, how long do women typically stay in your program, and what happens after they leave? Like, how would you measure, like, success for a client who comes to your program, Kelly?
So I guess, you know, every individual is different as far as how long they stay, and it depends on their needs. But on average, you will see them stay anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks. So the shelter is really meant as a short-term kind of intervention service, not something that would be long-term. Some programs like the Spring of Tampa Bay, they do have more long-term housing options available. But essentially for the emergency shelters, typically pretty short-term. And so I think that, you know, really just focusing on getting them, I guess, that stability, identifying what needs they have as far as, you know, do you need childcare? Do you need employment? Do you need housing? You know, and depending on those complexities really is going to determine how long. But sometimes they'll come in for just a few days. They needed a chance to regroup, and they've got, you know, they're relocating to another location, another state. They just needed somewhere to get that was safe in the moment.
And your program does accept women with children, right?
Yes, yeah, certainly.
I mean, because let's face it, usually the children go where mom goes, right?
They do. And especially when you're talking about abuse, they certainly want to remove them from the dangerous situation.
Right. Okay. What are some things that survivors wish that people understood better? You know, family members, workplace, colleagues, what are some things that your survivors wish that people understood?
So I think first and foremost is the common, and William, I'm sure you've heard the same, is why didn't you just leave?
Right.
So I think that's the biggest thing more than anything is, you know, thinking about somebody who's being abused and in a perfect world, I was just hurt, so now I'm going to up and leave. But not really understanding domestic violence and really that kind of power and control dynamic and how scary that can be. And I'm sure some of the victims you work with, you hear those stories of, I'm threatening your life. I'm threatening the lives of your family members. I'm threatening to take the kids away from you. I am threatening to, you know, tell everybody you're this horrible person. So that, one, will keep them. Number two, we talked about financial abuse. So I have no money. I have nowhere to go. And I think to William's point, it's really just sharing the available resources, because if people don't know that organizations like Sunrise, The Spring, CASA, they don't know we exist, who are they going to turn to? Because part of abuse is isolation, and that's isolating a victim from their family, their friends, their support network. They don't have anywhere to go. And if they don't know about a center, if I have no money, I don't have a job, I don't have a car, I don't have childcare,
right,
where am I going to go and what am I going to do?
Right. Are the programs significantly different between your program in Pasco, CASA in Pinellas, The Spring in Tampa, what did you say, Spark in Sarasota? Are there many differences between these programs?
So the core services that we provide, because we are state certified, and that's that certification is held by the Department of Children and Families. So every certified domestic violence center in the state of Florida has to have, you have minimum standards. We have to have our core services, and what those standards look like all have to be the same. And from there are some enhanced services. So I will tell you, majority of them are very similar, but some are larger, some are smaller. I mean, certainly, you know, Pasco County, our center is much smaller than that in Hillsborough County. Hillsborough County has a huge population. So yes, we provide some of the same services, but like the Spring has a daycare on site. We don't have that. Mm-hmm. They've got the transitional housing program and we don't have that. But as far as the emergency shelter, the counseling, the advocacy, the support, things like that, we certainly all of the certified domestic violence centers have those same core services.
Okay. What should friends or family do though if they suspect abuse in the family? What how should they approach a person to encourage them to get out of that situation?
I think it comes with compassion. My sister is a survivor of domestic violence, and that's why I got into this field of what I did. She had her ribs broken, her house shot up, and she never reported those incidents and never followed through with it. And so to hear her story after the fact and her talk about the shame, the embarrassment she felt and the confusion she felt, for me, like to have that someone so close, like she was my best friend, she still is to this day. And to see those emotions in someone who I cared about so deeply, but I was so blind to in the moment, I think is critical. So I think people just need to keep an open mind and be compassionate. There's this urge to want to tell a survivor, like, you need to do this.
Right.
You need to do that. But the reality is they don't need one more person in their life telling them what to do when they're in this cycle of power and control and being told what to do consistently by their abuser. And so I think it's just about being there to lend an ear, to have an outlet, and letting that survivor make the decision that's best for them. Because sometimes safety planning is important. It might not be in their interest to file an injunction right away if their abuser, you know, knows where they are, or, you know, is vindictive, or, you know, is on drugs. Like, there are so many other factors. And that's why we try to refer them to agencies to make that safety plan and have those conversations, let them have those thought processes without someone directly telling them, you need to do this or you have to do that.
Wow, good advice. Thank you.
Yeah. I want to just mention too, because that is really profound information and advice to share, but also sometimes a survivor is just not ready to make that phone call. They're not ready to seek services, and maybe they don't even realize that they're in that situation. But even as a family member, a friend, a colleague, a coworker, you can still reach out to the Certified Domestic Violence Center in your area and ask for that support. Help me safety plan with my sister. Help me safety plan with, you know, my colleague or my friend. What are some things that I can do to try to help them remain safe, or at least kind of be that bridge to that gap so that they can eventually come into services or reach out? And, you know, and I think what's important is that you don't have to come into services to call any of the hotlines. And everything, every certified domestic violence center is free of charge. It's confidential. You don't have to give them even your first name if you want to call the hotline. You can just remain anonymous and you can still get that support. So I think that's really important for survivors to know, is that I can call, I can talk to somebody who's trained in safety planning, who is trained in working with survivors, and I don't even have to give them any information. I can just get the information.
Well, before I forget, let's get that hotline number out tell our listeners, you know, these numbers to call in the event that they have reason to call, whether it's someone who is experiencing abuse themselves or whether it's someone who is calling on their behalf.
So I can tell you our hotline for Pasco County, and what's also nice is that there is a statewide hotline, but all of the certified domestic violence centers in Florida are all linked in some way, and they all work in partnership. And so even if you're in, you know, Hillsborough County and you call Pasco, we're able to then refer you back down to Hillsborough or the service provider in your area. But so Sunrise's 24/7 hotline is 352-521-3120.
Okay. William, is there a hotline that you want to offer our listeners?
Yeah. So for the Spring of Tampa Bay, their hotline is 813-247-7233. And that's a 24/7 hotline as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. We may ask you to run that again at the end of the show, which we are coming to. All right. So Should we be doing a better job with, like, youth and kids talking about, you know, healthy relationships and domestic violence and, you know, what to look out for? I'm concerned that, you know, we've had so much restriction of our sex education programs in the state of Florida, and consent used to be a big part of those programs, and I don't think it is anymore. And I think that that's a real deficit for us. I wonder, you know, what would be your advice about how to talk to kids about this? Because even if they're not getting it in the schools, you know, maybe they could get it at home.
So I think, you know, even starting at a really young age and, you know, really kind of focusing on anti-bullying and, you know, because essentially that's where it starts at a pretty young age, is when you start to perpetuate becoming a bully, and that can progress on. So certainly with the younger kiddos, you're not going to talk to a, you know, 6 or 7 year old about safe dating and safe relationships yet, but right. anti-bullying. And then as they transition on into older ages and they start dating, is really kind of talking about equality, you know, safe and healthy relationships. Talking
consent,
about boundaries,
right?
Yep, and boundaries. What are you comfortable with? What are you not comfortable with? And just because you consent to this today doesn't mean you have to consent to it tomorrow.
Or with the same, or with a different person.
Sure.
You know, right?
Mm-hmm, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that I would hope that there would be some reconsideration of what we teach in schools. You know, when kids have to be there, it's an opportunity to deal with issues like bullying and consent and give them more tools, maybe, you know, to deal with these things and to recognize them when they see them in their peers. So, all right, how can we, you know, it's got to be such a tough job. I personally never wanted to do family law or divorce work because, you know, what they say, with criminal law, you see bad people at their best, and with family law, you see good people at their worst, you know, and in my law practice, I certainly found that to be true. I never wanted to do family law. The amount of burnout that I see happening among my former colleagues in the law who did this kind of work was just astounding. So let me ask you, how do you deal with that? How do you prevent burnout and, you know, feeling overwhelmed and depressed by this work? How do you help your staff through that? You know, both of you.
Yeah, there's no denying that burnout in the field of domestic violence is huge. Advocates, prosecutors, a lot of people have this exposure, even if it's brief for months, and they're like, this work is just not for me. And we've seen that turnover where people kind of just like, you know, I can't handle it. And
right.
So, you know, it is a constant challenge that we are facing, but it's about, I think, communicating. So for me, this is my 5th year now supervising the domestic violence unit and kind of being involved in that, but I'm aware that it's not for everybody. And sometimes you have to check in with your folks. And sometimes that means like maybe you need to take a vacation, take some time off. And I also like to celebrate our successes. We see a lot of awful in the work that we do. You know, it's a lot of sad stories. Not every case can be proven. Those are the realities of the work that we do. But if we can focus on maybe the one victim we were able to help and kind of share that as a group and talk about that success, I think it's a motivating factor that there is so much value and good in the work that we can do and accomplish, that I try to focus on the good, even though there is still bad.
Yeah.
I think what's kind of cool is hearing from a state's attorney's office perspective and then looking within an agency that provides services too, and how very similar those support systems and that kind of support network is within an agency is pretty neat. Because too, you know, you'll have the individuals that are, you know, like our staff that are working and providing direct service to survivors. Sometimes you'll just hear a story that's really, really heavy. And, you know, leadership staff within the agency and just colleagues really kind of identifying that in whomever had just kind of heard that story and saying, hey, you know, I just need to process this for a minute. I need to talk. This was a really tough case. This was a really tough story, and I need to process it. So really that peer support is really important. But then also identifying when, you know, for us, we really try to focus on having touch points every month with staff so that we can, you know, what are you doing to take care of yourself? Whether it's, you know, ensuring gardening and stuff, but just bringing that up on a routine basis and remind staff that, ooh, I do need to take care of myself. I do need to, you know, take care of number one first before I can take care
of
others.
Yeah, that's the airplane advice, right? Mm-hmm. Put on your own mask first, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And that may be, you know, that may be the kind of thing that is very, very necessary among both the staffs of both of your organizations, because it does seem like a very, very heavy, heavy lift for people who work in the area every day, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Well, let's then talk about the positive. What, you know, what does success look like in what you do, how you try to help survivors, or are they even survivors if they come to you? You know, how do you evaluate whether someone is in fact a survivor if they come through your program briefly and then they go back to their abuser, or if they come to you, William, to the state attorney's office and then they drop their prosecution? I mean, how do you, you know, what is a survivor?
So I want to share a story because I feel like it was pretty powerful for me. And so sometimes that instant gratification of the work we do is not present, right? Certainly you can get a prosecution for you know, the state's attorney's office. That might be a success. For the domestic violence centers, those stories are not always immediate. Certainly a success is them coming to you. Certainly a success is them leaving that abuse. Whether they stay with your program or not, it's still a success. But so I started a long time ago with Sunrise, and when I was working specifically, I was the counselor at our shelter program, and I remember working with a mom, and she had two twin boys and then an older son as well, and she, you know, went through our shelter program and she moved on, and you know, I kept doing my work and moved to our outreach program and then became the CEO. Well, every year, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And so we host a candlelight vigil, almost every other center does. And in our info email at Sunrise, it comes to my main email address too. It's forwarded to me. And I got this email from somebody saying, it's my 20-year anniversary. And I went through Sunrise and I would love to come back to the candlelight vigil because that was really special for me. And I kid you not, I had goosebumps reading it because it was a survivor that I had worked with in shelter. And I remember sending her an email back saying, here is when it is. And by the way, this is Kelly. She came to she drove from, you know, over an hour away to attend a 2-hour long candlelight vigil. And the tears in her eyes when she was actually able to see myself, who had worked with her all those years ago, that's that pivotal moment for her. This was the agency she reached back out to because, in her words, you saved my life and you saved my children. And that's my success. 20 years later, that is my success.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that story. What about you, William? How do you feel about the success of what maybe a survivor is or isn't?
Yeah. To me, it's more of a process. Each survivor knows their situation is unique. It's unique to them and their abuser. A survivor's success story might be the fact that they just got away from their abuser and they never had to encounter them again without going to court, ever having to split assets with them or divorce or injunction proceedings. And that might be their version of success because they're now in a safer space and they're able to put that chapter behind them. Obviously, in an ideal world, you know, we want to hold every abuser accountable for those acts of domestic violence. They are illegal, and be able to hold them accountable to get convictions on their record, and to make them either do programs or in some serious cases go to jail or prison. Those are also ideal situations, but to see a survivor go through that process is a process. They have highs, they have lows, and you have to level with them. And sometimes there are days where it's too much for them, and you have to recognize that that's okay. Like, why don't we check back in tomorrow? Like, and I think it's so important to have rapport with survivors and check in with them constantly because what their end goal is can change from day to day.
Yeah, right. Well, let me ask you both, how can laws or policies better protect survivors? Is there something missing in the process that you think would be of great value? What kind of changes would make the biggest impact right now? Is there something that you think would be helpful that we don't have?
So I think for me, I'm always going to direct it back to perpetrator accountability rather than having the burden being put on the survivor, right? So I'm always going to kind of revert back to whatever that accountability looks like, whether it's batterer's intervention programming or, you know, substance abuse, whatever that might look like. But, you know, the victim's not the one that did something wrong, right? And so putting all of that burden, whether it's, you know, parenting classes or whatever it might be, you've got to go to counseling or you have to do this. That person's the victim. And so,
well, how does someone, I mean, they can be sentenced into those programs when they go through the court process in Williams Division, but is that the only way that someone who's an accused abuser can get those kinds of services or be mandated into those kinds of services?
As far as court mandating, they can be mandated through the injunction process as well.
Okay.
So a civil judge who's doing the injunction hearing, hears evidence, can actually order them to participate in a batterer's intervention program. It's still court ordered. It can also be part of a criminal punishment. If they're sentenced on a criminal case, they have to complete that batterer's intervention program as well. I know a lot of places offer voluntary batterer's intervention classes, and I know like the VA services also provide kind of domestic violence resources to service members. So there are different programs available, but for court-ordered batterer's intervention, it usually comes as a result of a judge.
Through the court system. But these programs like Sunrise of Pasco or The Spring, they have programs for people who could enter voluntarily if they went through like some sort of counseling. Is that available?
For a survivor or for
no,
the perpetrator?
For the perpetrator. Like if through counseling somehow someone who was a survivor came through your program and convinced their partner, you know, that they needed counseling or something like that. Are there, because people don't have a lot of money to go through therapy, for example. Even court-ordered programs cost money. They make people pay for them. So, like, is there a way for a person could get that kind of counseling, that kind of assistance, you know, through the social services programs?
I can't speak necessarily because I really kind of deal with the victim services side, but certainly I do know that there are voluntary, like batterer's intervention programming. You can enter voluntarily as far as what support is, you know, financial.
Who offers that? You said the VA offers that?
I know they offer not necessarily certified batterer's intervention programs, uh-huh. but they offer programs for domestic
violence.
Like
anger management?
Exactly. And other services for service members. But the batterer's intervention programs are usually done through DCF-approved providers, and there's a network of them.
Okay.
And I know some of them try to be flexible with, like, payment scales, like setting up payment plans, and some even have, like, an indigency option where if you are below a certain income, then you only have to pay a certain copay. So I know there are resources in
place.
That's
good to know because I know that that was one of the real barriers to getting people help, even through the court system, was money, because they're required to pay, then they can't afford to pay, then they don't pay, then they get recycled through the system and they just never get out. They never have the opportunity to succeed because they can't continue to participate if they're not paying, and then they get their probation violated if they're on probation. It's a mess. I did note that Representative Omar Blanco, who's a state House representative from Miami, filed a bill that would make available faith-based content in these domestic violence counseling programs. It wouldn't mandate it because I think that would be a violation of the First Amendment to require people to participate in faith-based content counseling, but it would make it available as an option to participate in a faith-based counseling program. I'm not sure. Maybe that would be useful to some people. I don't know. But that is currently pending in the legislature. All right. And we only have a few minutes, but I did want to just get on record. What is the first step that people should take if they want to get a divorce, but they can't afford to hire a lawyer? That's really important. So let's get that on the record.
Yeah. So there are other resources as well. So Bay Area Legal Services also provides legal services to people who can't afford traditional lawyers.
Bay Area Legal Services in Hillsborough.
That's
and
correct.
In Pasco?
They're also in Pasco County as well.
Okay. So if you can't afford to get your own lawyer, go to Bay Area Legal Services, speak to them, and see if you qualify for their services. Okay. Now, if people want to support the Sunrise Center of Pasco, how can they do that? Do you take volunteers?
So I think I just want to echo my appreciation for even being here today, because my number one way of supporting the agency is to just know we exist and know, and if it's not just Sunrise, it's all of the certified domestic violence centers. So the Spring in Tampa Bay and CASA in Pinellas County. So just really knowing the resources and knowing that we exist so that a survivor doesn't have to go without services because they didn't know we existed. But certainly accept volunteers, you know, monetary donations, in-kind donations. We have wish lists on our website, which is sunrisepasco.org. So, I mean, you name it, essentially a 24/7 shelter is going to need support from, think about from the time you woke up this morning until the time you go to bed. That is what we have to, anything you use or consume, we provide to those that are in our shelter.
Yeah, because they often come with nothing, right?
Certainly, and I know it sounds so cliche to say they come with a trash bag full of stuff, if anything, but that is really truthfully what happens. They come with their belongings in a black garbage bag, and it's pretty sad. And so, you know, we really want to try to provide them with the support and the humility, even luggage, you know, luggage that you might not need anymore, you don't want, you can donate.
And
to the
centers. You have a thrift store, right?
We do. We have Solutions Thrift Store, which is up in Dade City. And what's neat about that social enterprise is not only it does the proceeds go to support survivors, but also they're able to shop there for free with through a voucher system. And so, you know, it really benefits on a number of levels.
Okay. And William, I don't imagine that there's a lot of volunteering in connection with what you do. I don't know if the victim advocates are employees, paid employees, or volunteers, but I know that they're an important part of what you do, right?
Yeah. We have paid victim advocates, but we also have internship opportunities.
Okay.
So people can actually intern with our victim advocates and get that exposure. So let's say they're at, you know, USF getting...
studying social work
exactly,
or something, yeah.
They can get that practical experience on that side while still being able to do it. But also interns for attorneys, too. We have dedicated interns who specialize in our domestic violence division.
Okay.
Who can have that exposure.
All right. So all you law students, this is your chance. All right. That's all we have time for today, friends. I want to thank my guest, Kelly Sin of the Sunrise for Pasco Domestic and Sexual Abuse Center, and William Warmke, Domestic Violence Division Supervisor for the Hillsborough County State Attorney's Office. Thanks also to our WMNF volunteers, Jessica Green and Barbara Fling. And thanks to our new Midpoint volunteer, Daria Miranova, who did a great job prepping me for this show. Remember, next week, Midpoint will be kicking off our spring fundraiser. If you appreciate what we do here to bring you the news and opinions that challenge what you get from legacy media, please make a generous donation to WMNF to help keep independent non-commercial media going. You know, we lost all of our government grant funding, and now we have to fill a big hole in our budget, not once, but every year going forward. My fundraising goal has been increased, so I've come up with a really cool thank you gift that I'm offering only to Midpoint donors who contribute $88.50 or more. It is a branded and engraved large metal whistle that says Community Safety Machine on it, like Woody Guthrie's guitar said that this machine kills fascists. Well, the Midpoint Whistle is a machine that will keep our community safe. You can use it for icy conditions or just to call your dog, but I promise you'll love it. It has a full-color logo for WMNF and WMNF's Midpoint on each side, and it comes with a lanyard and a very nice gift box. It's a perfect gift for our times. So run, don't walk, to your computer and make a donation of $88.50 or more, and direct your contribution to Midpoint or MPW in the drop-down menu. And remember to note that you'd like a whistle in the comment section, and we will get it to you in as a thank you for your donation. Now, I would like you to stay tuned for Talking Animals after the NPR News. We are WMNF Tampa.